The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
This episode is brought to you by my friend Rebecca Walzer. Rebecca is a financial expert who can help you protect your wealth during this volatile market. Book your complimentary call with her team by going to friendofdinesh.com. Today I'm going to talk about the progressive fallacy, the progressive vision of Woodrow Wilson, recently elevated, by the way, in an important case by Justice Kagan. A new case that the Supreme Court is going to take up is going to go to the heart of how elections are run in America. Debbie and I are going to talk about the best-run cities in America and what's the common thread that makes them work. And congressional candidate Carmen Maria Montiel is going to join me. We're going to talk about her plans to unseat the notorious leftist Sheila Jackson Lee. And I'm going to continue my introduction to Homer's Iliad. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Show.
This voice. The times are crazy. In a time of confusion, division, and lies, we need a brave voice of reason, understanding, and truth. This is the Dinesh D'Souza Podcast.
In the Supreme Court's recent EPA decision, this was West Virginia versus EPA, the issue front and center was the ability of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, to use the broad rubric of the Clean Air Act, cleaning up the air, to somehow wipe out the coal industry, impose prohibitive regulations that would cause essentially coal companies to go completely out of business, and proceed from there on the basis that this was a crusade that the EPA would lead to take on climate change. And the Supreme Court basically said, no, that's not something the EPA has any congressional authority to do. The actual Clean Air Act was passed under Nixon, 1971, I believe. No one was even talking about climate change. That wasn't the delegation of authority. And so if Congress wants to make new laws that deal with climate change, that's a separate issue. They can. But the EPA can't just take it upon itself to launch this kind of a crusade. In other words, the executive branch doesn't get to make laws or to arrogate to itself authority that has not been delegated. It does what executive branches do. It carries out what Congress instructs it to do, and that's it. That sets certain bounds or parameters. Now, interestingly, as often happens when there is a sort of a narrow debate about the reading of the Constitution, there's behind it a deeper debate about some competing sort of philosophical foundations. And Eleanor Kagan, in defending the EPA and in her dissent, she invokes Woodrow Wilson. And she says, well, listen, Woodrow Wilson, by the way, was a great champion of the regulatory state. And Woodrow Wilson, by and large, believed that a country needs to be run with expertise. The ordinary person is not an expert, nor is the ordinary person, Wilson thought, smart enough to pick experts. The ordinary person doesn't know who else knows. And so the ordinary person picks politicians, but those politicians, Wilson believed, their job also was to defer to experts. And who are these experts? Well, people like him, progressives, people who in some senses laid a claim to the future, people who claim to know more, have more centralized knowledge than the ordinary guy, and therefore would be in a kind of superior position to run things. And of course, Wilson didn't believe that there was sort of one type of expertise, but he thought there was, you needed expertise in this and expertise in that. And particularly the various functions of government all required independent types of expertise. Now, again, It's not that anyone disagrees that when you have a nuclear power plant, for example, it requires expertise. When you're dealing with issues like manufacturing, like pollution, you need expertise. The question is, who sets the policy goals within which that expertise operates? That's really what the Supreme Court was arguing about. And very interestingly, Justice Gorsuch dives into this invocation of Woodrow Wilson, the kind of founder, you might say, or the first president to be a progressive Democrat. Remember, Wilson was then followed by FDR and LBJ. So these were the three progressive Democrats of the 20th century. And think of collectively what kind of harm they have inflicted on the country. And Gorsuch kind of dives into Woodrow Wilson, and he points out that Woodrow Wilson, in Wilson's eyes, he says, the mass of people were, quote, selfish, ignorant, timid, stubborn, or foolish. So Wilson's disdain for the ordinary citizen. Wilson even then starts talking about, he denounces the men of the South for being fools, and then he goes on to denounce immigrants. He says, quote, the immigrants were getting a, quote, from the south of Italy and men of the meaner sort out of Hungary and Poland. In other words, what kind of quality of person is coming to America, says Woodrow Wilson. These are not the kind of people who need to be either running things or even deciding who runs things. They possess, quote, neither skill nor energy nor any initiative of quick intelligence. Once again, Wilson is here contrasting himself with all these supposedly rude and buffoonish characters. And finally, Wilson makes the point, he goes, we're trying to achieve too much through democracy. In other words, too much deference to the people, too much deference to the vote. Wilson's point is it should be done by experts. It should be done by people who really know what they're doing. And what Gorsuch is capturing here is the arrogance of this, but not just the arrogance of it. It's the deep anti-democratic thrust that is being carried out by a party that goes by the name of Democratic, the Democratic Party. But the Democratic Party here is against democracy in the very ordinary sense of the term. They're against the people. They're against the idea that this ordinary citizen kind of has a pretty good idea of what kind of life he or she wants to live and the kind of people that they want to represent them and the values that they want to guide government. According to Wilson, there should be some mechanism, and you can see here how you sort of have the road to socialism is being paved here. You need to have a superior sort of people who are qualified, supposedly, by their education and their learning, and there has to be some mechanism for selecting those people and putting those people, not the ordinary citizen, nor the choices of the ordinary citizen, in charge. Recently, I told you that Walmart has canceled MyPillow. Now, Walmart's not going to be stocking Mike's products at their stores. Crazy. When are these retailers going to stop letting the left bully them into submission? Well, enough is enough. Mike always fires back. He's always coming up with great new products. And I'm excited to announce the MyPillow sandals. Summer is here. You need some waterproof sandals to go to the beach and the pool. These sandals aren't just practical. They're super comfortable. We got some and can't believe how cushiony they are. Regular price of these sandals is $79.98, but they're on sale now for $49.98 with promo code Dinesh. So time to go get some. 800-876-0227 is the number. That's 800-876-0227. Or go to MyPillow.com. Don't forget to use promo code D-I-N-E-S-H, Dinesh. People sometimes ask me, what is the impact of a documentary like 2,000 Mules going to be? What can you reasonably expect from a film that is, after all, a film? Well, as it turns out, with something like this, particularly when a film breaks out, when it begins to be seen by a lot of people, when it begins to become an understood term in and of itself, you don't have to explain what 2,000 Mules is, you just invoke it and people kind of know what you're referring to, is it has a reach, kind of like dropping a stone into a pond. The ripples actually flow pretty far out and sometimes in ways difficult to anticipate. So here we go. The Supreme Court just announced on Thursday, this is before signing out and taking off, the Supreme Court said, we're going to take a case in the next session. Now, this is a session that will have a little bit of a different court, right? Breyer will be off. Judge Ketanji Jackson will be on. But this is a case involving elections. And the case that the Supreme Court is going to decide is who makes the rules governing elections. Now, let's turn to the Constitution. The Constitution says that the time and the place and the manner of election shall be, quote, prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof. And the Constitution says almost exactly the same thing with regard to presidential electors. So the Constitution is, in a sense, very clear. There's only one group that decides elections, and that is in each of the individual 50 states, it's the legislature of those states. So you might think, well, isn't that the way it is now? And the answer is no. We have a kind of complex process in many states in which a mixture of legislators, yes, but election administrators, state judges are calling the shots. And this was particularly true in the 2020 election. You had all kinds of people making decisions about voter ID laws, about absentee ballots, about drop boxes, about signature matching, about deadlines for receiving absentee and mail-in ballots, for where drop boxes should go. In many cases, these issues were decided without lawmakers having any say at all. The Secretary of State would decide, a local judge would decide. And so in North Carolina, you now have a fight. And it's made its way up to the Supreme Court. Now, this fight is specifically about redistricting. The North Carolina Republican legislature drew some districts, and a Democrat appointee court judge decided to strike them down. They said, these lines are too friendly to Republicans, and so go redraw them. So essentially, a judge is saying is, I get to say how these elections are going to be organized, even though the Constitution appears to give that authority exclusively to the legislature. So the Supreme Court is now taking that up. And from early indications, the Supreme Court is not happy with this kind of grab bag departure from the clearly outlined mechanism that is specified in the Constitution. In fact, here is Justice Alito weighing in on this very point. If the language of the Elections Clause is the clause I just read, is taken seriously, there must be some limit on the authority of state courts to countermand actions taken by state legislatures when they are prescribing rules for the conduct of federal elections. In other words, the 2020 operating principle where state judges decide, you know, what We'll make the decision. We'll second guess the legislature on that. Yeah, the law says that all the ballots have to be in by election day. But as you remember in Pennsylvania, we'll take them even if they come in 3 days later. So the Supreme Court goes, this is unacceptable. This is not what the Constitution says. Now, of course, we need to find out how all the different judges are going to weigh in on this. But it looks to me that there's a fairly clear, at least 5-4 majority for essentially deciding the simple point that that election rules are made by state legislatures and state legislatures alone. They are the final authority on that matter. And the left is already freaking out about this. Here's Ocasio-Cortez. We are witnessing a judicial coup. We're witnessing a judicial coup. First of all, the court hasn't heard the case yet. It's going to. The decision will probably be next year. It's not going to affect the 2022 election, but it will affect the 2024 election. And remember what the court's job is. The court's job remains what it always has been, which is to look to see whether or not the rules that are prescribed in the Constitution. Remember, the Constitution is a kind of super law. The Constitution is a law that overrides other laws. Now, there are mechanisms for amending the Constitution, but short of that, the Constitution has the final say. And the court's job is to read the Constitution in an accurate and, you may say, faithful way. Not just read the text, but read the text in context. And here, the text couldn't be more clear, and the context couldn't be more clear. The court is saying elections are complex business. This is not going to be decided federally. It's not going to be decided by the court either. It's going to be decided by states, and the legislatures have the final say. That's what the Constitution specifies. And yet that's not what is being carried out now. That's not the way that things were run the last time around. And I think the court has realized, and this could be where 2000 Mules has an impact, the court goes, well, you know, we don't know what we can do about the things that have happened before. but there are things that we can do to fix things down the road. And it might be that even the Supreme Court is now taking action, recognizing that we have something of a confused and broken process. Are you watching your retirement slip through your hands every day? Are you worried about a black swan market event that could inevitably be coming? This is an event that comes out of nowhere and basically decimates your accumulated savings. That's not all. Interest rates are going up, inflation skyrocketing. Well, how do we protect our money? How can you get ahead of what's happening with the economy? This is not a time to wing it or go with a hunch. You need a qualified expert on your side. Well, I'm not an expert, but my friend Rebecca Walzer is. She's a tax attorney and wealth strategist with her MBA from the London School of Economics. Rebecca and her team will help you to prepare and your money for the turbulent times ahead. We all work hard for our money. We can use some really good guidance to help us build on what we have. Go to friendofdinesh.com and book your complimentary introductory call today to see if you qualify. That's friendofdinesh.com. Let Rebecca Walzer's team of experts protect your wealth during these unprecedented times. In the last segment, I talked about how the Supreme Court might be taking the view that one can't do very much about the past election, but the court might take steps to tighten up the process, bring it more in line with the Constitution for the 2024 election. But I think that we shouldn't take the view that 2020 is in the rearview mirror and that somehow this is something that we need to, quote, move on from. Yes, in the end, we do have to move on. But I think we don't want to move on without some reckoning of what happened in 2020. And I came to this view really not initially, but after I did all the work I did both to do the movie 2000 Mules and the accompanying book, which, by the way, comes out at the end of August. You can pre-order it now on Amazon. It's called, well, you guessed it, 2000 Mules. But there's a little tag that says the full story. Why? Because there's going to be more in the book than there was in the movie. Now, initially, when I began work with True the Vote, Debbie and I did, I took the view that, look, we want to make a movie that's going to tell the truth about 2020, and we want to try to fix things in the future. But it never crossed my mind that we want to do anything about 2020 itself. And yet, the more I dug into it, the more I realized, well, if a grievous injustice has been done, then you can't simply, quote, move on. Think about, I've mentioned this example other times, the Tour de France. If Lance Armstrong cheated 7 or 8 times to win, cheated during the Olympics, well, I mean, don't you take away the guy's medals? You just say, let's fix the Tour de France for the next round so it doesn't happen again. Let Lance, of course, have his glories. No, you want to deprive him of the fruit of the cheating. Now, people say, well, Dinesh, this is, what are you saying? I mean, this is kind of unprecedented. Elections can't be overturned later after the election's already occurred. And the answer is, well, they actually can, and they actually have been. Now, we haven't seen a presidential election overturned, I admit. But I want to talk briefly about what happened in North Carolina in 2018. This is Congressional District 9 in North Carolina. And a guy named Mark Harris, a Republican, was running against Dan McCready, Democrat. And Harris won, but he won very narrowly. They were just won by a kind of edged out Dan McCready. And it turns out that the margin of victory was provided by the absentee ballots, by the mail-in ballots. Now, Mark Harris, who was a good guy and a decent guy and a pastor, had hired another guy named McCray Dowless to work to be his man in Bladen County, which is part of his district, that district in the 9th district in North Carolina. But McCray Dowless, as it turns out, was a kind of a shyster. McCray Dowless was an illegal ballot trafficker. In fact, he was doing the exact same thing that we describe in 2000 Mules. In fact, he sort of, I won't say invented it, but he sort of perfected it. Now, you may think, wow, wait a minute, Dinesh, we're talking about voter fraud for the Republican. Yes, but as often happens, you know, by and large, when you find a corrupt Republican, you sort of scratch him, you usually find that the guy was a Democrat. And so it was this case. McCray Dowless used to work for a kind of black pack a group called the Bladen County Improvement Association. This was an African-American, quote, get out the vote operation, but get out the vote in their case meant get out the mules. So they were running a kind of dubious and corrupt operation. McRae Dowless was working for them. He learned the tricks of the trade, but then he got into a fight with them. And so they parted ways. And so McRae Dowless in a huff goes, well, I'm going to go offer my services to the Republicans. And so he did. So yes, we are talking about voter fraud that benefited a Republican candidate. But let's remember, Mark Harris did not know that McRae Dowless was pulling this kind of trickery. He just had heard that McRae Dowless is kind of, he knows how to get out the vote. And so he hired him in the confidence that this guy would deliver for him, and he sure delivered. But little did Mark Harris know that McRae Dowless was like paying people to go door to door, paying people to get their absentee ballots, filling out the absentee ballots in his office. He would have, you know, he'd have basically his own staff serve as witnesses, even though they'd be like, I've witnessed the signing of the ballot. So all kinds of shenanigans going on here. And eventually the guy was busted. Now, here's the key point. An election board overturned the result of the election based on that, and there was a new election. In fact, Mark Harris, the candidate, stepped aside. Another guy, Dan Bishop, ran on the Republican ticket, and he won. He beat McCready. So he then became the congressman. But the point I want to make is that even though in this case it was an election board and not a court that overturned the outcome, the election board did not require it to be proved that all the sort of faulty ballots went for Harris. In fact, there was no way to know that for sure. The election board merely decided that all those ballots, all those fraudulent ballots, had put the election in question. In other words, they applied the but-for principle. But for this alleged fraud, might the outcome have come out differently? The answer was yes. And so since the outcome of the election was in doubt, they decided we need to have a new election. So I only mention this because it supplies not just precedent, but a relatively recent precedent that when there is a sufficient amount of fraud, and again, the kind of fraud we're talking about is identical to the fraud described in 2000 Mules, elections can and have been overturned. You've noticed it's pretty colorful at the grocery store in the produce section, all the vibrant colors of fruits and veggies. A friend, Dr. Howard at Balance of Nature, explains that all those colors you see represent nutritional variety. Different colors signify different key nutrients. So if you eat only your favorite one or two veggies, well, you're missing a whole world of vital nutrients. That's why Debbie and I take those six little fruits and veggie capsules every day. Each daily dose is made up of a blend of 31 different fruits and veggies. 31. So variety equals vitality. Give your body everything it needs with Balance of Nature. Invest in your health. Join me and experience the Balance of Nature difference for years to come. For a limited time, all new preferred customers get an additional 35% discount and free shipping on your first Balance of Nature order. Use discount code BALANCE. Call 800-246-8751. That's 800-246-8751, or go to balanceofnature.com and use discount code BALANCE. Chuckling during the last segment, and you said you had something you wanted to say.
So about the North Carolina voter fraud case. Well, the reason they overturned the election is because he was a Republican.
Oh, but.
See, if Republicans cheat, busted.
Well, let's remember, though, that, well, I was a little surprised that another Republican stepped in. Mm-hmm. And won the race.
Yeah, okay. Well, so, got me there. But I'm just saying, you know, if Republicans, see, they do it so seldom that I think that because that's an anomaly. Right. And so I'm not sure that it's going to set any kind of precedent.
Somebody on social media was actually saying something like, oh, Dinesh, you know what? Republicans do it, too. Mm. And I was like, have you seen the movie? We actually begin by saying that.
We acknowledge
it in the film.
Yes.
So we're not claiming that there's Democrats have a patent. We're claiming that Democrats have been predominantly the party of fraud. And that's just a historical reality. Hey, I want to talk to you about this report. So apparently there's a company called Wallet Hub, which looked at cities around the country to find out which are the best run cities. Mm-hmm. And they looked at 38 different kind of metrics. They call it quality of services metrics. Things like lowest unemployment rate or highest high school graduation rate, or they look at the crime rate and so on. Well, it turns out that the best run city in America, I've never even heard of it. It's called Nampa.
Nampa, Idaho.
Not Tampa, but Nampa.
Nampa, Idaho.
And,
wow.
Now, Boise is also in that list.
Okay.
Fort Wayne, Indiana, Nashua, New Hampshire, Lexington, Fayette, Kentucky. And I think what's interesting is that by and large, these are right-leaning cities.
Mm-hmm.
Not entirely, mm-hmm. but, of course, New Hampshire, for example, is these days a Democratic state, but much of New Hampshire is very conservative. Fort Wayne, Indiana is conservative. So it doesn't, you know, you've talked about how when you see a well-run state, everything is in order. There's no dirt on the streets. You don't see homeless guys.
We talk about this kind of a lot because we visit a lot of cities and we're always just amazed at how dirty some cities are versus others. And then we're like, oh yeah, the city council is all Democrat or the city council is Republican. You know, so it is actually city politics that determine what the city looks like. So it's quite interesting.
I mean, and to drive that point home, you can look at the other end of it. Mm-hmm. Here are some of the worst cities. Mm-hmm. Cleveland.
Oh, we've been there.
Bad.
Oh, yeah.
New York City. Bad.
Bad.
San Francisco, no surprise.
Oh.
Washington, D.C., no surprise. So those are four of the five worst-run cities in America. And look.
And that's what they want all of the United States to look like.
That's their model.
Oh, and Caracas, of course, is the biggest model of them all.
Because, if you look on the international scale.
Yes, because there's photos that I have of me as a child. And it's just so beautiful in the background. Nice, you know, nice everything versus now. You know?
Now, interestingly, what I think is that you've not only seen, not only is there this political dividing line, but even cities that used to be, I mean, cities have been Democrat for a while, but we've seen a deterioration in the cities. It's almost like the Democrats have gotten even worse at what they do.
Yeah, but I mean, it makes you wonder why that is. It's, you know, I grew up in the Rio Grande Valley, as you know, and when you go down there, you feel like you're going back in time. I mean, I literally turn on my 80s songs and I go back there and I like feel like I'm back in high school because it not only is it like, you know, nostalgic for me, but also just everything looks the same as it did when I was in high school. Actually,
right.
Worse because we had a new mall when I was a senior in high school and it closed down.
Yeah, and by and large, apart from like an, I mean, does the Rio Grande Valley have, does Harlingen have an Applebee's?
It does.
Okay, so Applebee's is like your top level restaurant.
Yeah, and I think McAllen is more hip. McAllen is about, I don't know, 40 minutes. I think it's west of Harlingen, I want to say.
Yeah, there's more
no,
there.
East of Harlingen, no, west of Harlingen. I'm going down this way. But anyway, and so it's a little more hip. But, you know, it's still not, you know, you go down there and you're like, yeah, we know who runs these cities.
And then you look at even things like, you know, there are beautiful homes, for example, in downtown Houston. There's, what's the name of that chic area?
River Oaks.
Mm-hmm. But all you have to do, you come out of River Oaks and you walk three blocks.
Yeah, but that's a zoning issue, you know. So,
well, whatever
it's a city run issue.
Right. That's what I'm saying is that you cannot insulate yourself no matter how well off you are. By and large, you're in the city and you can't change that. In fact, this was a point that my brother used to make, you know, when he'd talk about India in general, because his friends would go, India's a great place to live if you have money. And my brother would go, actually, no, it's not a great place to live if you have money because it still has massive potholes in the roads. The airport is still looks like a dump.
Panhandling.
And so you can't avoid the infrastructure of a broken country. Now, India is better now than when my brother said that, which is years ago. So India is on its way up. But so many of these cities are on their way down. We went to New Orleans.
And
I remember New Orleans as being a reasonably nice place.
Yeah, it was extremely dirty. And as you know, I'm kind of picky about stuff like that.
Well, nobody likes to walk in human excrement.
Yeah,
you know.
But I was just so grossed out. I was like, I just want to go home. I mean, they had so many nice things, but not worth it.
We were actually trying to find, was it the best bread pudding? Or what were we looking for?
Yeah, bread pudding.
We were looking for bread pudding in New Orleans. But ultimately, Debbie's like, forget about that bread pudding. Let's return to Texas. It's never good when the nation's supposed authority on economic policy completely misses the flashing red lights of impending inflation. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has finally admitted there have been unanticipated and large shocks to the economy that have boosted energy and food prices and supply bottlenecks that affected our economy badly that I didn't at the time fully understand, end quote. You know who understood the real threat of inflation? Well, people like me who invested in gold and silver with Birch Gold Group. They're protecting their savings, these people are, from highly turbulent economy by diversifying their 401k or IRA into gold, physical gold. And it's not too late for you to take action now. Text Dinesh to 989898 to get a free information kit on diversifying and protecting your savings with precious metals. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of satisfied customers, including me and Debbie, Birch Gold is the place to be. So text Dinesh to 989898 and get real advice from Birch Gold today. Guys, I'm really happy to welcome to the podcast Carmen Maria Montiel. She is running for Congress in Texas's Congressional District 18. Now, Carmen Maria was born in Venezuela. She was, in fact, Miss Venezuela, Miss South America, second runner-up in Miss Universe pageant in 1984. She's been an anchorwoman and broadcaster for TV shows, not just in Venezuela, but in Mexico, Panama, and Peru. She's lived in Houston since the 1990s. She's been on TV, Telemundo, Houston. There's a book based upon her life, Stolen Identity, which was released this year. And she's running against Sheila Jackson Lee, the notorious Sheila Jackson Lee, in Texas. Carmen, welcome to the podcast. Thank you for joining me. Let's talk a little bit about your story. Talk a little bit about what your experiences in Venezuela have meant to you and perhaps motivated you to become involved in politics in this country.
Well, thank you. First of all, thank you for having me. You know, I have been in the United States for 34 years. I came to college in Iowa State. So I have been here long enough to see the changes in this country. And I also lived in Venezuela long enough to have the experience of how the changes started and end up in what we all know today. So when I started to see the changes in this country, I started to realize how similar it was with Venezuela. When bureaucracy started to grow, when corruption started to appear in this country, which was something unheard of. It was completely, you know, this is the country of law. And thinking about corruption is something that we would have never imagined. But nowadays is part of the culture. So little by little, I started to experience it. I started to compare, especially with Obama. That's when I think the change became more noticeable for me. And I started to remember all the teachings my father taught us, because my father always told us, you need to go to the United States, you need to study there, you need to stay because it is over here. So then with my experience through the judicial system, realizing how corrupt it was, and then realizing how the economy was being affected, how middle class especially has been affected. The first thing socialism do is end the middle class, that I decided to stand up and do something. I say I cannot be with my arms folded and realize what is happening and just do nothing. And that's how I got involved and into politics and became active.
Do you think, Carmen, that as an immigrant and as somebody who was raised in a different country, it gives you a certain kind of dual perspective, a double vision, in which you look at America, but in a context of other countries so that you can compare and contrast? Obviously, the ordinary American can't do that. Do you think that that's an advantage that immigrants bring to being able to talk about American politics, because you've actually seen something go wrong over here and you can now apply it to America?
Most definitely. You know, one of the experiences when it started to happen in Venezuela is the Cuban immigration we had. We have a solid Cuban immigration because of Castro. So the Cuban immigration, they told us in Venezuela, hey, this is happening to you. Of course, when it first happened, you don't realize it. So now I have the experience, and it started, say, years ago, you know, what is happening here? And when people tell me, oh, America will never go that low, and I said, well, that's what the people in Venezuela used to say. And of course, you know, having the experience, nothing like experience, is what, you know, bring us to be more aware of the situation.
Carmen, talk about the district in Texas. You're running in Texas. Now, Sheila Jackson Lee is a little bit of an institution, and in the particularly in Houston, in the kind of inner city of Houston, this has been a kind of Democratic stronghold. Even though Texas is a conservative state, the cities, and in particular Houston, but also Austin, they lean left. So talk a little bit about how someone like you has a chance to win in a district that otherwise might seem very difficult to succeed in.
Well, I believe that we need to do different things. The problem is keep on doing the same thing and expecting a different result. So historically, the people that have run against Sheila is basically the same, but I've been looking at this district for a while. The demographics used to be before remapping, you know, because of the census, all the districts were remapped, redrawn in Texas. We gained 2 seats. And before the remapping, the top demographic group was Blacks. The second was Latins, white, and Asians. And I was looking at the district and say, how about a Latina running against Sheila, you know, to do something different? You know, I said, let's stop doing the same thing. But just with the new, you know, lines that were redrawn, now the demographic changed. And now the top demographic group is Latinos. 44% Latinos, 35% Blacks, 17% white, and 4% Asian. And you have seen how Latinos finally realized we're conservative. I always said we're conservative at heart, but Latinos were duped by the Democrats. And that's what I said. This is the opportunity to make a difference. And if we add that, and then we add the situation the country is in it right now. You know, my daughter, my 26-year-old daughter just told me that she's going to start, you know, riding her bike more often because it's costing her $100 to fill up her tank, something that used to cost her $35. So it's affecting all of us. So I think all the ingredients and the changes in the demographics and the fact that Latinos are voting, you know, conservative are there to make a change this year.
I mean, Carmen, this is extremely encouraging because, as you know, we're seeing shifts in the south part of Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley. But if you can make inroads now starting in cities like Houston, I mean, the implications of that are absolutely huge. So I want to wish you all the best in the race. Tell people where they can find out more about you. What's your website? Where can people go to learn more about you and to support what you're doing?
Well, my website is carmenforcongress.com, for F-O-R. And you can also find me, you know, Instagram, same thing, Carmen for Congress. Facebook, Carmen for Congress. Twitter is Carmen for Congress. Is the only one that is with a 4, Carmen for number 4 Congress. And you can find me in all those places in the website. They can sign up. Everybody can sign up to be a volunteer. It doesn't matter what part of the country you are. You can make calls. It doesn't matter what part of the country you are. You can make donations. You know, that's the name of the game. And to make a difference. And like you say, we need to regain our cities. Because that's the problem in Texas. The left took over our cities, and we need to gain back our cities to conservative values.
Absolutely. Carmen Maria Montiel, thank you very much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Some of us wish we could rewind the clock when it comes to our health. Exercising, climbing stairs, all the things young people take for granted. Well, these aren't things that have to stop just because you age. Neither do you have to merely endure the normal aging aches and pains. Now there's a 100% drug-free solution. It's called Relief Factor. Relief Factor supports your body's fight against inflammation. That's the source of aches and pains. The vast majority of people who try Relief Factor order more because it works for them. Debbie's a true believer. She finally gets to do her bar exercise class now that she's alleviated her frozen shoulder thanks to Relief Factor. Debbie knows if she stops taking it, well, the pain could come right back. So she's like, I don't want to be without this again. You too can benefit. Try it for yourself. Order the 3-week quick start for the discounted price of just $19.95. Go to relieffactor.com or call 833-690-7246 to find out more about this offer. That number again, 833-690-7246, or go to relieffactor.com. Feel the difference. All right, we're going to dive into the opening section of Homer's Iliad. Before we do, the Iliad, the name Iliad, comes from the term Ilium, which is the Greek name for Troy. Odyssey, of course, is obvious. An odyssey is just a journey. So Homer's Odyssey is a little bit more of a self-evident title. Now, Homer, the bard who is credited with essentially composing both the Iliad and the Odyssey. The belief today among most scholars is that there wasn't sort of a single Homer. In other words, one guy who composed from start to finish, almost as if Shakespeare composed The Merchant of Venice or Othello. That was entirely the work of Shakespeare. But in Homer's case, that was not the case. There's a kind of a bardic tradition of composing ballads, and bards would take other people's work and kind of rework it to their own ends. So I think when we think of Homer, we shouldn't think of a single author, although there's no question that there is a kind of narrative unity to this work. And what that means is that there is somebody at some point who brought all of this together and told this story in this way. And there's nothing wrong with calling that person Homer. So, with that, by way of introduction, let's jump into the text. The first word of the Iliad is rage, rage. In Greek, it's the word manes, or it's actually in its conjugal form, manen. But the word is used by Homer in this epic only to refer to the anger of the gods. And by using this word here now, there are many words for anger, for rage in Greek, but by choosing this word to open the epic, Homer is implying that he's going to be talking about a different level of rage, almost, you could almost call it a superhuman rage. And that's not entirely surprising because we're dealing with a character who is a sort of a superhuman. I won't call him a superhero because that would actually degrade him in a way. But a character who is something more than human, and this is the Greek warrior, the Greek hero, Achilles. He is the son of a human man named Peleus, but of a sea goddess. His mom is Thetis, who is a sea goddess, and the marriage was arranged by the great god Zeus. And so right from the beginning, now Homer doesn't say this, but he expects his audience to know this, that Achilles is something more than human. So here we go. Sing, goddess, Achilles' rage, black and murderous, that cost the Greeks incalculable pain, pitched countless souls of heroes into Hades dark, and left their bodies to rot as feasts for dogs and birds, as Zeus's will was done. So right here in the first line, all the main themes are present. The rage of Achilles, the consequences of that rage. It wasn't just about Achilles' rage. This rage caused innumerable deaths. It caused a tremendous amount of pain. It sent a lot of people to their graves. Their bodies were feasted on by dogs and birds. Their souls, of course, go to Hades, which is the Greek underworld. We'll talk later about what Hades is all about, what kind of afterlife is envisioned by the Greeks. And then we also have this remarkable conclusion to the line, as Zeus's will was done. And this is introducing now an important theme in the Iliad, which is the theme of fate. I'll say a lot more about fate later, but here I just want to say that the idea here is that our future is, at least to a large degree, fated. We'll even discuss what role the gods have, if any, in altering that fate. As we'll see, the gods have some role in being able to change what happens to someone, but they're not able to change the overall outcome. They're not able to change the outcome of the Trojan War. They're not even able to change, for example, the outcome of the death of Hector or the death of Achilles, although they can change the way that we get to those outcomes in the end.
Imagine the lifelong impact of a journey to the Holy Land. Surrounded by like-minded travelers, picture yourself stepping foot in iconic locations right out of Scripture. Join Dr. Sebastian Gorka and Dinesh D'Souza on this life-enriching Israel tour, November 30th through December 9th, 2022. For more information, call 855-565-5519 or visit standwithisraeltour.com.
After his opening line, Homer plunges us right into the story of the Iliad, and we might expect the story to begin with some sort of a clash between the Greeks and the Trojans. After all, the Greek ships are parked right at the beach. They are in the middle of a fight with Troy, and we might expect the conflict to begin there, but it doesn't. It actually begins inside of the Greek camp. And there is an argument, very bitter as it turns out, between the leader of the Greek expedition, Agamemnon, and the great Greek warrior, Achilles. Now, what is this argument about? The argument is that Agamemnon has taken away Achilles' concubine, a woman named Briseis. The concubine was given to Achilles as part of the booty or prize of war. Now, Briseis is not a Trojan. She has actually been a woman captured in one of the nearby cities allied with Troy. Troy has not fallen. The Trojans are fighting bravely even in the ninth year of the war. But it's customary in this culture of the Homeric warrior that you capture not just wealth and gold and booty, but also women. So Achilles has this concubine granted to him as part of his prize. It's sometimes called a geros. She's his geros. And the whole thing to us seems a little bit crazy. Debbie's even chortling a little bit. Oh my gosh, what are we talking about? Well, you know, we are talking about the 13th or the 12th century BC. So let's remember, we're in a culture very remote from our own. And what appears to be very trivial. I mean, here is Agamemnon, taking back, you know, Achilles' girlfriend. And Achilles goes into a rage and basically declares, I'm not going to fight in the Trojan War. Not only am I not going to fight, I'm going to take all my troops. They're called the Myrmidons. They are essentially the people from Achilles' city. Achilles goes, they're not going to fight either. In fact, Achilles says, we're going to pack up and go home right now. And moreover, Achilles goes, I'm actually going to wish that the tide of the war turns, at least temporarily, and that the Trojans have huge victories against the Greeks. So again, not just from Devi's point of view, but from the point of view of a lot of students who read this, Achilles' anger seems unreasonable. It seems like Achilles is like way out of line here. What? Not only are you upset about something that should seem relatively trivial, but you are withdrawing from the conflict. You've come all the way. The Greeks have been fighting for 9 years. And you, their best warrior, are going to quit. And you're going to take your troops with you and you're going to go home. And you're actually going to pray or hope for a reversal of fortune in which the Trojans are going to win great victories against the Greeks. it is my job, not just today, but over the next couple of days, to convince you that Achilles' attitude is not unreasonable, and that within the culture of Homeric, of the Homeric warrior, Achilles' reaction is correct, and that Agamemnon's action is far beyond taking away a concubine. It actually deprives the Greek warrior of the only reason why the Greek warrior is fighting in the first place. So this now raises the profound question. Why are the Greeks fighting? Well, the obvious answer is, well, they're fighting to take back Helen. Well, yeah, but what does Agamemnon have in it? Well, it's his brother, Menelaus' wife. Okay, but are you saying that Agamemnon mobilized a massive expedition of 1,000 ships because his brother's wife was stolen by another man? What about the ordinary Greek? Why is Achilles fighting? What does he care about Helen or Menelaus? He's a king of a different Greek city. So we now have a question that needs to be answered, which is, in the culture of the ancient world, what is the motivation for warriors to risk their lives, risk everything, and in this case, in a faraway country? You can kind of understand why the Trojans are fighting, because the Greeks are there. The Trojans are defending their city. They're defending their cattle. They're defending their families. They're defending their way of life. But what is motivating the Greek warriors? If you understand this to start, you begin to see why Achilles' rage, far from being unreasonable, is in fact right and proper.
Subscribe to the Dinesh D'Souza podcast on Apple, Google, and Spotify. Or watch on Rumble, YouTube, and SalemNow.com.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.